From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, it's an unusual media project for you this week. Welcome to an opportunity for a half hour of commentary, analysis, and perhaps even some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. What's unusual is that, well, let me introduce you to the table. Over at the end is Kaylin Brown, head of the journalism program at the College of St. Rose in Albany. How are
you? Good to see you, Rex.
Great. Good to see you. And Judy Patrick is next from the New York Publishers Association. No. Yep. The New York Press Association.
Yes, I'm glad to be here.
Great to see you. Judy is the former editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. There's a gap, isn't there? Who's missing? Who was it?
We're good. We're
okay,
good.
Okay, that's great. Dr. Alan Chartok is not with us, so we are just the three of us doing the media project today. It'll be very difficult, and if one of you pipes up at some point and says...
It's three against zero.
That's what Alan often says. Absolutely. Well, you know, the big media story, of course, of the week, dominating media outlets, has been the coverage of children separated from their families, depicted in distress, I would say, and it has really evoked a remarkable response in the public. Certainly, it's been a big deal. But let me just read you something written by Pat Kiernan of CNN. It took days of relentless reporting on this angle and 100 others before the Trump administration backed away from a shameful policy. This is why we have a free press, and this is why the cries of fake news are so sinister. Jake Tapper says, it's not an accident that the U.S. government is making it so difficult for journalists, lawmakers, lawyers, and others to bring you images and firsthand accounts from these separated parents and children. They are hiding the truth from you because they fear your reaction. So what do you think about these comments?
Well, I think journalists right away got themselves to the border and to the detention facilities as soon as they possibly could. We see amazing images and recordings of children separating from their parents with crying toddlers even. The fact that those images were gathered and the journalists managed to get that out as quickly as possible certainly affected the conversation nationally and ultimately affected what happened with an executive order.
But as we sit here right now, there is much we still do not know, and that's because the federal government is not allowing journalists inside some of these shelters, so we don't know what they look like, and you have to wonder what's happening inside that they don't want us to see. We don't know where a lot of these children are being kept. We don't know what their future is going to be. There's so much either they don't know or they're willfully not telling the press.
Absolutely. That is that even though there have been some tours of some of the facilities, it is true that that's only happened in a few cases, and the journalists have not been allowed to record anything. So the images we've seen have been those that have been sneaked out by people working there, right? Or images presented by the government itself.
And ProPublica had those sounds of children.
Oh, they were haunting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's just incredible. You know, you wonder what the role of the press is, but images, video, and audio can be so compelling. And one of the things I've been listening to is the Fox News people are presenting images that make it look like these detention centers are summer camps or boarding schools. You know, we've all been in situations where the government says, yeah, come on in, take a look. And that's when they've shined everything up and everything's polished and the kids are being well cared for. That's propaganda. That's not real news. That's not the facts.
Yet Tucker Carlson of Fox News told viewers last week they could only trust Fox News. He said, we don't have the audience that the big networks have. He meant the broadcast networks, CBS, NBC, ABC. But he said, you should assume that what you see there is false. And that if you want the truth, you should only turn to Fox News.
And he's supposedly legitimizing himself. But those who are not paying attention to Fox News on a regular basis recognize that what Tucker Carlson says is generally not legitimately accurate.
And as long as we're talking about faults, can we talk about dishonesty here? I mean, from the administration, we've gotten lie after lie after lie, dishonesty after dishonesty. And the press, at some point, I guess, gets tired of calling lies lies, but it's been a series of lies about why this policy or this action was taken and what's causing it and what prompted the reversal. Really, the press is doing a pretty good job of holding the administration to account, but the dishonesty is rampant.
And in fact, it was reported this week that the president's dishonesty is actually increasing. In fact, the rate with which he is lying is becoming more than it had been.
So what do you do when there's so much of it?
What do you do when there's so much of it? And when you know that there is a significant percentage of your audience who will believe what they hear, that we are the ones who are lying, but when your research proves beyond a doubt that what you're reporting is accurate and what the president is saying is not true, when the president lies all the time, what do you do about that? It just presents a very difficult situation because it is hard to present what is supposed to be a fair news report that is accessible to everybody, no matter what your political beliefs are, which is what we all try to do, when you know that people are predisposed not to believe you because you don't share a political bias that they have. Very difficult.
You know, I've never seen anything like it. You know, occasionally you'll see a politician lie and then you call them out on them and they stop lying. But this is, it's become part of our national culture, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And it's really undermining a lot of our core values.
It is interesting that throughout the controversy until the president signed the executive order to keep families together, there was consistent reporting on the part of the mainstream media that he was not telling the truth. It started to become just part of the way this was reported. The president falsely claimed that this was because of Democrats in Congress that this policy was going forward. And it was a false claim, which he repeated over and over and over again, but which you then heard picked up by talk radio, by the Trump claque, which repeats anything and accepts everything he says. So it is difficult because in truth telling, you end up aligning yourself against a political movement, and that makes you seem partisan when your partisanship is actually that you're a partisan for the truth. It's really an awkward situation.
Interestingly, the New York Times made its way to Stephen Miller, who is one of the president's right-hand men, to get a lengthy interview about his position on not letting immigrants into the country and also breaking up families. That interview was an in-depth interview that the Times reported. They then, after the fact, wanted to have a podcast and use the recordings from those interviews with Miller. And the Times took some heat from the industry because they believed that the Times should have used the recording of Miller anyway and used it on their Daily Show podcast. But I am not of the opinion that the Times failed when it chose not to use the recordings because they had not set the ground rules ahead of time. It was after the fact that they asked for that recording. And I think that journalists have to adhere to the ground rules that they establish with the source. I was okay with them not doing that, but the point is the Times did go to the source of this immigrant policy, talk about it, and revealed more information showing what the truth is about who's making decisions.
Right. The criticism was this, just to repeat, because it is a bit of a complex thing. HuffPost had this story, and when I first saw this on HuffPost, I thought, wow, that's interesting. New York Times caves to White House on Stephen Miller interview, which was saying, why didn't the Times use the tape of this interview on its podcast? Michael Barbaro of the Times hosts this podcast, this fine podcast called The Daily. So why was it? Well, that's an interesting question. And what you're saying is you think that it's right for them not to have done so because when they went into the interview with Stephen Miller, there was not a clear statement that this is going to be recorded for use as a podcast.
Exactly right. You have an obligation as a journalist to set the ground rules as best you can based on what you know about the interview you're about to conduct. You have to prepare. It's one of the things that journalists do to get ready for an interview. But it wasn't because they hadn't prepared for this podcast called The Daily. I understand why the White House decided to say we didn't agree to those terms, so we prefer not to use that. That's their choice to say that. Of course, you can tell a reporter anything, but the Times had a choice. They could have used it, but they honored their agreement, which to me shows some integrity on the part of the Times.
Part of the problem in this case was the fact that the podcast as presented was they just said, oh, White House asked us not to do it, so we're not doing it. There was no real explanation that first day. They followed up the second day with a little bit more explanation, that explaining that the interview was recorded as part of a print interview. You know, going forward, every reporter I know usually says, do you mind if I record this? They don't say, do you mind if I tape you for print or for digital? Did Stephen Miller agree to a print and digital story? I think we have to be more broad when we ask these kinds of questions going forward, because it can end up in a tweet. I mean, did Stephen Miller agree to have any of his comments or his quotes tweeted out? I agree with Kaylin. You don't want to hit someone with a surprise like this. Ultimately, though, I want to know why Stephen Miller didn't want this stuff broadcast. Is it because he has a snarky tone? I'm just suspecting.
Interesting. That could be. Maybe the notion is that he isn't the best face for the White House, though he is the clear policymaker. I mean, he's one of the kind of three key advisors the president still seems to listen to.
And so think of the irony of that the White House is saying, we prefer the Times vet this and use its filter and gatekeeping role when it reports the story in print, as opposed to presenting exactly who we are and what we're saying, because perhaps there is some fallback or, you know, backlash that would happen.
I don't even think the Times is reporting the transcript. They're not releasing that.
You know, it is interesting that in this era, it just shows that our heritage as print publications, in the case of the New York Times or in the case of my newspaper, where we still delineate, and I think our public and the sources we're dealing with delineate, and they think, well, I'm speaking to a print outlet. But in 2018, the fact of the matter is we are all of that. We are ink on crushed trees and sound and video. And so increasingly, the right thing for us as journalists and for the people we're interviewing is to understand that whatever is said, whatever is used, can be used on a variety of platforms. But that just needs to be made clear from the get-go. We can't just sort of spring this on people, because we are in that transition period when folks still aren't comfortable with the widespread dissemination of stuff digitally that they were doing. It's kind of a... Now, here's one question, though, that was raised by the guy who runs 538, Nate Silver, who said that it was, quote, a rather explicit acknowledgement by the Times that it is willing to make sacrifices to preserve its access to senior people within the White House. That is, that by giving into this White House request, no, don't put that tape out there because we didn't agree to that from the get-go, that you're actually maintaining a relationship with the White House that might be bruised by refusing to honor their request. Is that okay? Is it okay to make that kind of a trade-off?
Negotiations are made every day by reporters. I think it's completely okay to do that. You want to preserve what access you have. You have to maintain your integrity, and you have to remain ethical and accurate. So there are times when the only way to get a source on the record is a particular way. And if that's the only way that person will talk to you, providing you don't pay for it, which under no circumstance should a reliable journalistic sort or outlet be paying for sources, I think that it's justified.
My bet is the two reporters involved in the interview were the ones arguing not to broadcast the tape, that they probably were the ones that had the initial discussion with the source, and they are the ones that want to protect it, because you don't want to burn bridges, and you want to play fair. And I think there is a level of trust, even when you don't trust the politician or the person talking to you, there is a level of trust, and there's some sort of contract that you engage in when you talk to someone for a story.
You know, I think that's true. And you find that your best investigative reporters often are people who maintain contact, maintain good relationships with even the people who are affected by their reporting. Our investigations editor, Brendan Lyons, I'm always amazed that he can go back to people who have been bruised by what he's written, but you know they're never surprised by him. They know what he's going to report because he's fair and accurate, and he'll say, you know, this isn't going to look good for you. The story's going to be in tomorrow's paper. Let me tell you about it. And I think people appreciate and respect that. sometimes.
I actually think it's a little problematic, Rex, when you said HuffPo was sort of one of the groups that jumped on the attack mode against the Times for its decision not to use the recording, because I don't know that that's justified. If HuffPo took a minute to step back and think about what they do, hopefully they're adhering to journalistic standards too, and they would make agreements with sources and then stand by those agreements and uphold what they agreed to do.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's a cheap shot by Nate Silver against the New York Times, just a cheap shot.
Okay, so we are here at the Media Project. If you have your views, share them at media@wamc.org. We are Kalen Brown, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith here without Dr. Chartok today, and I can just hear him listening to the radio at home saying, "No, no, you are wrong." It's too bad. I'll try to do that. No, I won't, on his behalf. So here's something interesting. We don't talk a lot about political cartoons because we're sitting here on the radio where you can't see the stuff, but I'll tell you, there's been a great controversy about a political cartoonist. There's a guy named Rob Rogers. Rob Rogers was a political cartoonist based at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. His work, very good stuff, was syndicated widely. 34 years as a political cartoonist in Pittsburgh. And recently, he's been doing a lot of cartoons that were rather critical, perhaps even harshly critical, of the president. And repeatedly, his cartoons have been spiked. And this was finally resolved by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette firing him. And this has led to condemnation by the National Cartoonist Society and so on. But the question is, well, what issues does this raise for you?
It's a little bit of a sticky wicket, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Because the publishers can have, it's an opinion. And so whether or not an opinion columnist or a cartoonist writes a certain way, I think one of the criticisms against him was he was doing too much about Trump, is too much about conservative politics, and do they have the right to get a cartoonist that they believe more is more in line with the politics of that opinion page?
Mm-hmm.
That is definitely a possibility. This cartoonist was well regarded, very very good, won a lot of prizes, and he just got frustrated too.
He hadn't had many of his cartoons killed over the 35 years he was working for, or
right,
working in cartooning, especially with the Post-Gazette. And then it was just in the last couple of months that the rate with which the editors were choosing not to publish his cartoons rose exponentially. I think it's hard for a cartoonist or an opinion maker to not pay close attention to what's happening with this administration. It's almost like low-hanging fruit to me. It's so easy to do it, but maybe that's part of the problem. It's so easy, but do we pick apart every problem coming out of this administration? Because it's so chaotic and it's infinite, the number of issues that we as the media could pay attention to. I don't know how you discern when to stop picking on what's happening.
It's a good question. We have these conversations every morning at our editorial board and feel as though we could, if we wanted to, write about national issues and write about Donald Trump every day, because our editorial board disagrees so vehemently with so many things that the administration is doing. But we try to write about our community, about local issues, about state issues, and we try not to sound shrill. And therefore, your relentless attack on the White House is, of course, not really a smart thing to do in the context of all the other topics that we ought to keep our eye on. It is interesting that The guy who owns the Post-Gazette is John Robinson Block. He's a very conservative guy, but the Post-Gazette was not a paper that supported Donald Trump for president. You know, there was only one major newspaper that editorially endorsed Trump, and that's the Las Vegas Review-Journal, owned by the casino magnate Sanford Adelson. But the Post-Gazette, you know, it is an interesting point, Judy, that you raise, that the publisher has the right to determine what the tone of that opinion page is going to be. And yet, when you give somebody a column or a slot as a cartoonist, you are saying, I want to hear your voice personally. I want to hear what you have to say.
Right. Are you stifling their free speech, or is the free speech belong just to the newspaper in that
right.
circumstance?
Well, you know, the cartoonist is, Rob Rogers is absolutely free to draw his cartoons.
Right. But are they free? Must they be published?
Right. Just not free to draw them for the Post-Gazette.
And it also depends on what kind of a newspaper or what kind of a publication you are. Are you a small community newspaper? Are you a big national newspaper? It depends on what your mission is as a publication.
By the way, speaking of people losing their jobs, a three-month unpaid suspension, you may not have heard of this, for the noted Boston Globe columnist Kevin Cullen. He's a very popular Metro columnist for the Globe. People in our listenership area who may be Boston Globe readers probably are shocked to not see Kevin Cullen's work. But the fact is, he had written some columns about the Boston Marathon bombing that were both factually inaccurate and implied that he was present and had seen things that, in fact, he had only watched on television. So a three-month suspension without pay is a pretty harsh judgment, but it does speak to the fact that there are controls in this industry, right?
It does. It was a radio station that started scrutinizing this newspaper columnist's work. So it was a reporter at a radio station who started fact-checking what Cullen had done and saw that there were a bunch of facts that were manufactured and did not line up with the fact-checking this radio broadcaster had checked on.
It's incredible that a columnist would dare to do such a thing, that when you put your words in print, or even if you say them, you don't want to say things that are not true or an exaggeration. You think people would know that, but there's such pressure to write the best story, the greatest column, to add those details, and that's one of the things that got him into trouble was these heart wrenching details he would put into the stories that just weren't true, I am surprised also that readers didn't write in and say, hey, that's not true, or that didn't happen. Why didn't any of the sources step forward? I think maybe it reflects the fact that people don't always believe what they read in the newspaper.
Mm.
It's bad for us.
It's bad for us. That is true. Finally, just maybe a little bit of time for us to talk about our responsibility to the people that we are reporting on. When there are tragedies, floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, even reporters descending upon border towns in South Texas, what do we owe the people that are our sources? The veteran journalist Max Robinson writes about that after he had covered some significant tragedy. And he writes this: despite our best efforts as journalists, we report on the messy details of people's lives as outsiders looking in. We typically don't consider that getting such details wrong could have massive ramifications for a story's subject or their family. The role of a journalist as an outsider is kind of essential to having a perspective on things, but it also gives us, it also takes us into sort of a cold place where we make calculated decisions about what we're going to use, and it's a difficult place to be.
One of the things I used to look for when I hired reporters was empathy, and that I wanted the person to have empathy for whoever they're interviewing. But there's also that pressure to get the interview, to get the story. And if you don't get the story, you've lost. You've failed. And there's that pressure. And it's increasing nowadays when reporters are being asked to get the story fast.
But empathy, and I agree with you, the best reporters have empathy. That's why we're getting the good coverage out of the border towns, I think, because they can imagine, what would it be like if I were trying to rescue my family and leave the circumstances I am in? And then I go and if I end up talking to a reporter, you know, what would that reporter share? What is that reporter going to share? I'm a parent. I think everybody at this table is a parent. Wouldn't we be sympathetic to another parent, and we would know what might be damaging to them if we included maybe their full name and we're trying to preserve their anonymity? There are instances, and I'm not a big fan of anonymity, but there are instances when that's justified. We have to be careful of our sources. It's imperative. And if we take accuracy seriously, then I think that less damage will be done.
All right, on that point, we're going to have to call it a day. No three against one. No, we're out of time, but we hope you'll join us next week for a more typical media project. Kaylin Brown, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith here with gratitude to you for joining us on The Media Project.
Shut up, Rex.
Interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.